It's the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack in for Faith. This show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. The ability to perform under pressure is one of the differences between good athletes and extraordinary athletes. We find the same thing in everyday life as we take exams, give speeches, perform solos. For some, these pressures can be daunting, while others take them in stride. Imagine having to pilot a damaged plane or make life and death decisions in an emergency room or fight in combat. Why do some people seem to perform well under pressure while others choke? Actually, my guest will tell you, nobody performs better under pressure. Regardless of the task, pressure diminishes our judgment, decision-making, and performance. Today, my guest is Dr. Hendry Weisinger. He's a psychologist and pioneer in the field of pressure management. He's the author of several books and has taught in the business schools of Wharton, UCLA, NYU, Cornell, Penn State, and MIT. His latest book, co-authored with J.P. Polifry, is Performing Under Pressure, The Science of Doing Your Best When It Matters Most. He lives in Westport, Connecticut, and joins us today in the studio. Dr. Hendry Weisinger, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Nice to have you. So as I just mentioned, you say that people do not perform well under pressure, but some sure look like they do.
People do not perform better under pressure, even the most elite athletes. But what they do is they are not affected by pressure, which is the case for the majority of people. So that is a real myth when we think, why do people perform better under pressure? The question should really be, is why do those people not perform below their capabilities?
And why don't they?
Well, because, you know, when you understand what a pressure situation is, which is when you have something at stake on the line and the outcome is dependent on your performance. That is a pressure situation. So a student who is taking a test, it's important to them. They have something on the line, getting into Yale, getting rejected from Yale. Those students who do well are just not doing below their capability. A C student, for example, is never getting 1600 on their SATs. But many times an A student will frequently choke and do below their capabilities. So when I first started working on this, I was under the impression, like most people, that the edge in life is rising to the occasion. You hear that in the media all the time, especially in the sports world. And what I learned, looking at research studies from all over the world, people do not rise to the occasion. They just do not do worse than they are capable of. So when an athlete like Tom Brady, for example, throws touchdown passes in the Super Bowl and everybody says he's rising to the occasion. No, he isn't. He throws touchdown passes all season. He's just not doing worse, whereas
right.
For other people, they get rattled and they do worse.
What happens to us when we're under pressure?
If I had to personify pressure, I would say that it is a villain in your life. Its job is to weed you out, to get rid of you. Remember, nobody ever comes home from work and says to their partner, gee, I wish I was under more pressure at work. And what pressure does is it attacks our human performance system, which is a combination of our thoughts, our physiology, and our behavior. Think of it as a triangle, with each angle being one of those components, your thoughts, your feelings, and your behavior. And what pressure does, it attacks each one of those components. It makes us think in a certain way. For example, it creates what we call pressure distortions. One of the pressure distortions is when you have a big moment, you start to tell yourself, I'm never going to get this opportunity again. This is I call it chance of a lifetime thinking. And actually, you are quadrupling the stakes. This is why when you don't care about something, there's no pressure. If a student is taking a test and he already has locked in an A, there is no pressure because the outcome is totally irrelevant. So pressure, many times, the experience makes us mentally rigid. Now, that was good 25,000 years ago. You wanted to be mentally rigid in a pressure situation because you wanted to focus your attention on escaping from the predator. Today, when you become mentally rigid, it hurts you because you start to narrow your attention and all of a sudden you're not paying attention to other details that are very, very important. So it attacks our thoughts. It makes us blank out on things. It makes us forget things. How many times have you seen in a political debate when the person can't even remember what their, you know, what their thoughts are? Think of your internal physiology as a calm sea, calm water. We all like to be when the water is nice and calm. It's very pleasant. Well, what pressure does is that it gives a spike to that physiology. It arouses us. Your heart starts to zoom. You're beating faster and faster. You start to sweat. You start to breathe faster. It's like having an anxiety disorder. And pressure also attacks our muscular skeleton. It makes it more stiff. How many times have you heard a sports announcer say, he's too tight or she's too tight? They just need to relax. Relaxation is one of the great strategies that you have to be able to do in a pressure moment. So when you are asking at the beginning, why can some people perform better in a pressure situation, it is because they are using their natural tools, their thoughts, their physiology, their behavior to help them, whereas for most people it ends up hurting them.
So what you're saying is that we started out with pressure as a defense mechanism to protect ourselves, and that we have not weeded out in our daily lives at this point.
Most people have. I think one of the interesting concepts, at least from my opinion, is what I call primal pressure. And primal pressure is when you go into a situation and you literally make it a do-or-die situation. That's what you're telling yourself. Now, for your ancestors, it was a do-or-die situation.
Right.
You either performed or you are
toast.
Finished. Right. Today, when you give a presentation at work, it might seem like a do-or-die situation, but the reality it isn't. If you give a bad presentation, you're still waking up the next morning. So we have this overreaction, this primal reaction, which is never, ever going to go away, but that doesn't mean that it needs to surface. When I first started teaching, for example, at UCLA in executive education, I remember very clearly how I would tell myself, this is the most important presentation I've ever given. If I don't do well, they're never going to use me again. My career will die. These are the most important executives I've ever spoken to. I was actually increasing my own pressure by exaggerating the significance of the situation, making it the most important situation, and making it a do-or-die situation. The reality now, you know, 30 years later, where I've spoken to every major Fortune 500 company, prestigious groups, I'm not saying to myself, this is the most important presentation. I'm not saying these are the most important executives. Basically, I'm going in thinking, this is an opportunity. I'm going to educate these people. In fact, that is the biggest difference between people who do well, and I mean doing well, performing close to their best, compared to people who do below their capability. And study after study shows that when you perceive the situation as an opportunity or as fun, you do statistically significantly better in your performance. An athlete like LeBron James doesn't even use the word pressure. He will just use the word opportunity, or it's going to be great fun, or we're going to see if we are up to the challenge.
This is Dr. Hendry Weisinger. He's a psychologist and expert in the field of pressure management, and he's co-authored this book called Performing Under Pressure. You say there are three basic truths about pressure. Number one, pressure disrupts what we value most: decision-making, parenting effectiveness, relationships. Number two, people who handle pressure better than others do not rise to the occasion or perform better than they do in non-pressure situations, which you've explained. And number three, all of us possess natural pressure management tools, and we just need to balance them. One of those management tools that you describe in the book has to do with writing down your concerns or anxieties before a stressful event. But doesn't that just draw attention to your anxieties and make it worse?
No, it gets it out of your system when you write it down. That's like how many times you have something going on in your life, it's a problem, so you talk about it all day to your friends.
Yeah.
You just talk about it over and over, and then you finally reach the point, you know what, I don't want to talk about this anymore, I'm sick of it. that's exactly what happens. You are literally writing it off. So I would encourage parents, when their kids are taking a big test the next day, to have them write down their anxieties and concerns the night before. I have told many football coaches that your team the night before a game should all be writing down their anxieties and their concerns. It's a way of getting those worried thoughts out of your system. And there are many other strategies we can talk about as we proceed.
You are very careful in the book to point out that there's a difference between stress and pressure. Why is it important to understand the difference?
In every pressure situation, there is stress. But in every stressful situation, there is not pressure. A quick way to think of the difference is to think of pressure as the stressful moments that really make a difference in your life, that are going to affect you. If you were to ask 100 people, how do you feel when you are experiencing stress? The standard response will be, I feel overwhelmed. And that's what stress really is. It's a mismatch between the demands made upon you and your resources to respond. For example, let's say that after this interview, before the night is over, you have to go shopping, you have to pick up your kids, you have to call a friend, you have to do this, you have to do that. Now, that's stressful because you only have so many hours and you're only one person. What happens if you don't go to the supermarket? Big deal. You have milk in your house. You have food in your house. You're not going to die. A pressure situation is when you have to produce a specific response. The outcome for a pressure situation is success. That's the goal in a pressure situation. You have to be successful. In a stressful situation, the goal is to reduce the feeling of feeling overwhelmed. It's a reduction of feeling overwhelmed. In a pressure situation, you have to produce. I would ask people that when you experience stress or pressure, to ask yourself, am I feeling overwhelmed or do I have to produce? And if the answer is overwhelmed, you can take a 10-minute break. You can delegate. You can prioritize. You can take a nap. Now, if you're trying to land a plane on the Hudson River, taking a nap is not going to help you.
No.
There are many ways to reduce stress. There is only one way to reduce pressure, and that is an effective response. That is the outcome. Stress sometimes can be helpful. If somebody lazy, you can make them more productive by creating stress, meaning more demands. That's what stress is. It's a demand on you, but it's not a crucial demand. Where a pressure situation is a demand, but the difference is the demand is you must be effective. What happens to students if they can't handle the pressure at a university? What happens to them?
They fail.
Exactly. They are weeded out.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to a company that can't handle the pressure of change?
It fails.
Exactly. They are weeded out. So that's really the difference. Pressure never helps you. Never helps you. When people say they thrive on pressure, that is not true. They might be thriving on challenge. They might be thriving on opportunity. But by definition, you know, nobody invented pressure. It evolved. And its goal is to get rid of you so that the remaining group is at a higher level. That's the evolutionary utility of pressure.
Can you say more about perceived pressure? Maybe it's a serious case where it's not a life-threatening situation, but you are experiencing it as if it were.
Most people confuse the two. And as a result, they are on high alert 24/7. People in the retail business are like this, for example, who manage a store. Every morning they wake up thinking, I got to meet the quota. I got to meet the quota, as if it is a do or die situation. So little things then become big things because they're treating everything as I have to be successful. It's a do or die situation. And those are the people that are on edge, as I said, 24/7. There's no relief for them.
This is Dr. Henry Weisinger. He's a psychologist and expert in the field of pressure management, and he's co-authored this book called Performing Under Pressure. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith. We're talking with Dr. Henry Weisinger. He's a psychologist and pioneer in the field of pressure management. And he's the co-author with J.P. Polifry of this book, Performing Under Pressure, The Science of Doing Your Best When It Matters Most. You say memories play a role in high-pressure moments, and that there are times when slowing down and being deliberate can help in a pressure situation, and then there are times when slowing down can make you choke. Can you say more about
that? Sure. First of all, because pressure speeds up our physiology when we become aroused, we tend to do things very impulsive. So for certain types of tasks that involve calculations, judgment, tasks that involve memory, your best bet is to slow your thinking down. That means if my boss says, I need an answer right away, the best response I can say is, okay, I'll get it to you as soon as possible, but not to rush. Because if you rush, you're going to do things impulsively. You're going to overlook key facts. Now, it's different if you're a golfer, if you're giving an audition. On tasks that are well rehearsed, that you've practiced over and over and over, slowing down will be disastrous. Because what's happening when you're slowing down is you're creating a disturbance in your coordination. Why is a golfer thinking about his swing that he's done 50,000 times already? Why is a dancer start to think, I better look at my dance steps. Am I doing it right? That's when he or she will trip. So the rule that people should remember is that on well-rehearsed behaviors, you do not want to slow yourself down. That's when the announcer says, he's thinking too much. And on tasks that involve judgment, decision-making, manipulation of facts in your mind, that's when you want to slow yourself down.
The book is divided into three parts. The first section deals with the science, what pressure does to our brain. The second section gives strategies to help us in the moment. And the third part talks about long-term solutions. And before we get into some of the solutions and strategies, can you say more about pressure traps?
Yeah, it's an interesting concept. One of the things that I've observed in a pressure trap, to define, is a conventional way of how we try to motivate other people. Incentives, for example. Corporate America is based on incentives to motivate people. Competition. Every CEO in America comes out and gives their pep talk. We have to be competitive. And also social support. We think that when you say to a person, I'll be in the fourth row, as the parent says, and I know that you're not going to let us down. You know, make us proud. We're counting on you. These are pressure traps because the intent is to help the person, when in reality, it makes the person wrong. Now, as an example, I'm a big college basketball fan, and I'm listening to the Tennessee University of Maryland game for the championship on ESPN. And ESPN would go into the locker room so you could hear the pep talks. The Tennessee coach, this is the coach after Pat Summitt left, says to her team, I want you to rip their hearts out. Now, what kind of message is this? Rip their hearts out? Now, let's go back 50,000 years. Two people find one piece of meat. There's not enough meat for both of them. How are they going to decide who gets it? They're not going to have a contest who can run the fastest. They're not going to have a contest who can jump the highest. It's going to be hand-to-hand combat. You're going to rip that person's heart out. So that is a primal type of message. The Maryland coach says to her team, play your best and they will remember you. Very different message. Well, Maryland won. And I am not surprised why, because competition does not bring out your best. It actually brings out your worst. There is a sports phrase that's called competitive arousal, and which happens where you start, instead of doing your best, you focus on beating the other person at all costs. Have you ever been to an auction?
Sure.
Okay, so you know how some people, they get into a crazy bidding? Mm-hmm. I just don't want the other person to have it and vice versa. It's like costly litigation. And as a result, the bills are running up. You end up paying more for the art object than it's worth. How right. is competition helping? And it's not a question of cooperation versus competition. It is the point that sometimes that competition makes you do worse because you're trying to beat the other person rather than focusing on doing your best. Now I understand why my father used to tell me, don't worry about the other guy. You can't control what the other person does. Carl Lewis, the most famous Olympian athlete of all time, said before a track meet that all he would focus on is doing his best and getting off to a good start. He's not worried about the guy next to him because he can't control it. So that is one point in terms of how competition, we think it's going to motivate a person, but it also motivates people to cheat because you have to beat the other person. It's like giving support. If your kid comes home and he says, Dad, you got to do me a favor. I'm really tired of being dropped off at school in this old Chevy that we have. You need to work harder, get an AMG Mercedes like the other fathers have and make me proud of you. Or Mom, you know, I got to tell you, you got to start going to the gym. You need to lose 20 pounds. Make me proud of you. But parents do that to their kids every single day. There was a big cheating scandal a couple of years ago in my hometown, Great Neck, Long Island, where I grew up, where five kids had hired somebody to take their SATs for them. Now, when I saw that in the New York Times, I laughed to myself because I grew up in Great Neck. And I said, you know what? Those five kids all had parents who had bumper stickers on their car, Yale, Harvard, and Princeton. And that was the truth. Otherwise, why else would they cheat? So competition brings out our worst. It doesn't bring out our best. And it's the same thing with support. Because now I'm the 9-year-old girl. I'm giving the dance recital. My parents are in the fourth row. So all of a sudden, I'm starting to think, am I making my parents happy? If I do poorly, are they still going to love me? Now, you have to remember 25,000 years ago, if I didn't please the group, I would get kicked out of the group. Your survival was based on that. You know, many people say that we don't want to disappoint others because that's another aspect of pressure. How responsible do you feel for the outcome? The more responsible you feel for the outcome and the more responsible you feel towards other people, the more pressure you are increasing. I have tons of quotes from successful people, and one of the things they all say is, I do this for myself. I am not doing this for other people. I am not here to live up to the expectations of other people. And the real fear is that you'll be abandoned. That's a primal fear. It's not a question of living up to you. It's, if I do something wrong and I apologize, if you say to me, it's no big deal, oh, I don't care anymore. If it's no big deal, what am I worried about? It's only of, I don't want to lose your love. I don't want to lose your acceptance. So it's really the fear of being rejected that gets to us rather than trying to do something for another person. And back in my therapy days, you know, I used to live in L.A. and I did a lot of therapy. And I always say, if you live in L.A., you have to do therapy.
Right.
But I was licensed to do it. And I would hear people say all the time, I was married for the person for 15 years. I did everything to please them, and it still wasn't good enough. And that is why one of the pressure reducers is to focus on your own interest and do what feels right to you rather than live your life trying to please somebody else.
This is Dr. Henry Weisinger. He's a psychologist, and we're talking about his latest book called Performing Under Pressure, The Science of Doing Your Best When It Matters Most. So you've mentioned kids a few times. Can you talk more about what the research says about kids and pressure?
I have to tell you that recently, because I'm working on a book now, Helping Your Kids Handle Pressure, subtitled Giving Your Sons and Daughters Life's Ultimate Edge. Well, recently, and people can look this up for themselves, I found an article on academic pressure in China. It is 10 times worse there than it is here. It's sad. When the two psychologists who wrote it, one was from Michigan, the other was from McGill University, and they have the journals that these Chinese students would write in. And one kid writes that ever since he was in ninth grade, it's like waking up under a dark cloud. That he writes that if he gets a 95 on a test, his father berates him. This is how you pay us back? after we do your chores, we get you good clothes. You have to remember, in China, the children are an extension of the family. So the kids have to do well because the parents are thinking, you need to take care of us when we get older. One kid writes that he only has 15 minutes of relaxation, which is when he walks home from school, and that's not even rest because now he's thinking about his homework. So, and look at the effects. I mean, there's been a big thing in the news in the last 8 months about all these suicides. Now, I'm not going to say that pressure is the main reason kids commit suicide or anybody does, but it is certainly a contributing factor. I mean, to the Yale University's credit, they have a terrific president, Peter Salove, who was the founder of emotional intelligence. And when he took over Yale, he said that one of his missions was to make Yale a more emotionally intelligent university. Now, a study recently came out saying that the five most stressful college environments were Harvard, Stanford, Penn, Washington University, and St. Louis. I forgot what the last one was, but Yale was not on that list. And maybe you saw the article in USA Today, it was just ranked the number one school in the country. I give him a lot of credit because, to me, that is being responsive to students' needs. All these other schools are, you have to produce. You want to go to graduate school, then you better be the top 10% of your graduating class.
Well, let's talk about some of the pressure solutions that you describe in the book. One technique is to change our thinking. Think in terms of a challenge or an opportunity, which you did mention earlier.
Yeah,
how does it work?
That is actually the idea of befriending the pressure moment. And the trick is to start getting rid of the word pressure and to use the word internally. This is an opportunity. This is a challenge. This is fun. And the word challenge is most important when it involves physical energy. You know, I would tell an athlete, see this as a challenge. But I would tell a student giving a presentation, this is an opportunity, or have fun. I have two kids. Every time they would have a job interview, I would say to my daughter, Bree, this is an opportunity for you. Have fun in it. All you have to do is talk about yourself.
Right.
They're not going to ask you anything that you don't know. You've been doing this for several years already.
But some people view opportunities as the potential for a missed opportunity.
Correct. You know, what we're really talking about is the mindset. What is a mindset for a person who does well in a pressure moment? And the first part of that mindset is you have to be positive. We are hardwired to be positive because when you're positive, it allows you to approach the situation with confidence rather than trepidation. So one of the ways that you can put yourself into a positive mindset is to use encouraging self-statements such as, I can do this. Remember, you're hardwired to do that. This is why depression is an aberration. Depression is a disease. It's like resiliency. Somehow we have gotten this impression that people who are resilient are special people. No, we're all resilient. You get sick, even without medicine, you're resilient. You get over your cold without taking anything. The real question is, why are people not resilient? That's why depression, I said, is an aberration. It's not the norm. So once you, it's like having a GPS system that you navigate yourself in a positive direction and you reboot that by talking to yourself in a positive way. I can handle this. I can be successful. I know I can do this. The second thing to do, as I said, as part of the mindset, is to view it as a challenge, an opportunity, or fun. People should write those words down on their desk. You have to give yourself reminders to talk to yourself like this. And the third part of the mindset, which deals with the question you just asked, is that there's always another opportunity. I was giving a presentation, for example, in Montreal to 500 financial advisors. And one young guy jumps up. And he says, well, how do you handle the pressure of asking a girl out that you really like? He said, for me, that's a lot of pressure. Now, before I could even respond, another guy jumps up, a few years older, and he yells out, just remember there's 100 other girls waiting for the same phone call. Everybody laughed, but everybody knew it was true. So always think in multiple opportunities. The idea being, there's another train coming. So what if you miss this opportunity? You're not going to die. There will be another one.
You pose a quick little challenge in the book. You say, of the following individuals, who do you think is under the least pressure? A golfer leading by a stroke going into the final round of the U.S. Open, a cardiac surgeon prepping for a quadruple bypass, or a baker beginning to roll the dough for his best friend's birthday cake. So clearly, the answer here is tricky because most of us would obviously say the baker is under the least amount of pressure.
Correct. But not if the baker is saying, this is the most important cake I've ever made. I have to make this great. If the golfer is saying, which is what the champion would say, this is just another round. And I can assure you that the cardiologist is saying, this is only a quadruple. I can do that in my sleep. What I'm really saying is you have to minimize the importance of the situation. You have to shrink the importance. Joe Flacco, before he won the Super Bowl, was asked, well, how do you deal with the pressure of the Super Bowl? And he said, it's just another game. Now, the media hates that because the media is thinking, oh, come on, it's the Super Bowl. But that's what he's really thinking. Why would he think any differently? If he thinks it's the Super Bowl and I have to show how great I am and so on, that's when he is going to do his worst. So minimizing the importance of a situation. When you're making a big deal about something to your friends and they say, stop it, it's no big deal, that is very good advice. That's what you should be saying to yourself.
Snap
it's no
out of
big
it.
Deal. That's right.
You have 22 of these solutions to help in the moment. If you could pick three of them, what are your favorites?
Well, one of my favorites, again, it depends on the task. I like the idea of what I call using a holistic word queue. See, when you go into a pressure situation, it's only natural that you're going to have distracting thoughts because that's what pressure does. And the way it distracts our thinking is that it creates these worry thoughts. What if I don't do well? What are other people going to think? So you start thinking of those thoughts, and all of a sudden you are out of the moment. Now, if I'm giving a presentation, instead of having a whole bunch of distracting thoughts, I am just going to use one distracting thought, a word that cues me in. My word would be fun. When I give a presentation, I want to have fun. And if I'm having fun, I know I'm doing well. What do I have to do? I have to entertain the people, tell them some funny stories. But I'm not going to go in there saying, I have to ask if they have questions. I have to tell a funny story. I have to give them good examples. Those are too many thoughts. I got to focus on what my main content is. So I would say to everybody, if you're having an interview coming up, if you're having a presentation coming up, if you're having a sporting event coming up, what is one word that you would say will describe how you want to come across? I said that to my son. I said, Danny, how do you want to come across in the interview? And he said, expert. I said, okay, so that's the only thing that you're going to say to yourself. If you say expert, that's going to cue you to be credible, to give examples, to sound like you know what you're talking about. You don't need a lot of mumbo jumbo. My second favorite is the multiple opportunities. That has really helped me a lot in my personal life.
This is where you use the example of if you miss the train, another one's
exactly.
coming.
Exactly. There's always another train coming. I invite everybody to ask themselves, when they were in high school, how many most important tests did they take in their life? Every test is the most important test.
Right.
It's like people in the speaking business. Every presentation is the most important presentation. And I would say another precious solution that I find to be very useful is sharing pressure feelings, especially if you're a male. See, in our society, if you watch a TV show, anytime you see a man, the male character, saying that they're feeling pressure, it's perceived as a weakness. I find that sharing your feelings reduces pressure almost instantly. Otherwise, you're trying to carry the burden on yourself. And that becomes a mistake. So when I say share your pressure feelings, it has to be somebody who you know is going to be supportive and somebody who is that you can trust. I'm very lucky because my three closest friends, one is a psychiatrist and the other is two psychologists. So for me,
you're all set.
Exactly.
Well, there's no fear of wallowing in that and making it worse by sharing it?
No, because what happens is they help you put it in perspective. If I were to say,
if your friends are psychiatrists and psychologists,
well, that is a risk sometimes that you have to take. I mean, usually what happens if you have a good relationship, the person's going to discuss your feelings with you, and many times point out. It's like my father used to say to me when I would talk to him about something. He'd say, "What's the worst thing that can happen? I don't get the job. Fine, then you don't get it. So then you find another one. You're not going to die."
This is Dr. Henry Weisinger. He's a psychologist and co-author with J.P. Polifry of this book called Performing Under Pressure. We're going to take a break. We'll talk about some of the long-term solutions when we come back. I'm Lori Mack in for Faith. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack in for Faith. Today we're talking with Dr. Henry Weisinger. He's a psychologist and expert in the field of pressure management. He's co-authored this book, Performing Under Pressure, The Science of Doing Your Best When It Matters Most. I want to get into some of the long-term solutions you talk about in the book. One of them is focusing.
And let me back up by saying that there's two types of strategies. Some of these are what I call the evidence-based solutions that are taken from research as a way of, here's a strategy that can reduce pressure, the feelings of pressure, immediately. And we've talked about some of those. There are other strategies that will help you do your best every single day, but it's not going to work tomorrow because you have to develop these attributes. And the key attributes are what I like to call your coat of armor, COTE, confidence, optimism, tenacity, and enthusiasm. Nobody invented these attributes. They evolved. The reason we have these attributes is they help us meet the challenges of life. How many times, again, you watch a sporting event and you hear the announcer say, "Oh, he's playing with a lot of confidence." You hear winners say, "Well, I'm optimistic about our chances." So those are the long-term strategies to develop those attributes. And tucked into those attributes is the concept, especially with tenacity, of being able to focus. A focus is not a skill. It's really a pathfinder. It leads you in the direction that you need to go. If you are a freshman in college and your long-term goal is medical school, to be a doctor, well, you know what? That's 8 years away. You got to get 4 years, you have to do well so you can even get into medical school. Then you have to be an outstanding student in medical school so you can graduate and then get certified. You have to go through your residency. So that is a long time to stay focused, which means that you can direct your attention to staying on a certain path. And if you can't do that, you're going to get derailed very quickly. This is why people who have an anxiety disorder are at an immediate disadvantage. 18 million people in the country have anxiety disorders. That means when they go into a pressure moment, they're behind the eight ball, because inherent in pressure is anxiety, the uncertainty of the outcome. If you knew that you're going into a situation and it's a guaranteed success, there's no pressure. But if the outcome is uncertain, we're on the edge of the seat. So you have to be able to have this mental focus where you can direct your attention. And one of the little exercises I would recommend is to increase their ability to focus for long periods of time by sitting in a chair, picking an object in the room. How long can you focus on that without having any distracting thoughts? I would say most people listening can do that for 2 minutes. And the idea is to be able to do that over and over and over for longer periods of time. And that's why focus is important.
Do you recall a story about someone who had a more serious case and how some of these techniques actually led to success for them.
Let me tell you how I first got into this. The first time I ever thought of dealing in a pressure situation was during my clinical internship out at UCLA in the Brentwood VA Hospital. And I was working on a ward. It was the first in the country that was exclusively designed for Vietnam veterans. This is back in 1976. And I had one client, as I would call them rather than use the word patient. I remember we'll call him Lewis. And he was getting ready to be discharged from the hospital. And I said, okay, now you need to call your mother and tell her you're being discharged. His mother lived in Brooklyn. And I said, you have 3 minutes to do this because that's all the time it should take. And you would think this would be a happy occasion. So he calls her up, and this is without hearing on a speakerphone. As soon as he told her that he was being discharged, she started bombarding him. You're sick. You can't get out. You can't stand on your own. And literally, he could not get a word out. I saw right in front of me, he started to sweat. He started to stutter. He started to shake. I had to take the phone away. He was literally choking in front of me. And I thought he was ready. I thought he was going to handle the phone call. Well, I now realized he wasn't. So for the next 6 weeks, I took him through sort of a methodology. We did role playing. I would ask him questions. I would act the part of his mother. I would bombard him. And I made sure that he could handle the situation. Then we did the phone call again, and he did okay. He got through it. Well, to end the story, about 2.5 years later, I bumped into him on the street. And he told me, he said, you know, I was really in bad shape there, but I built up my confidence like you told me. I started paying attention to all the little successes that I was having. I started to change my mind about my life from being so negative to being more optimistic. I started to focus on things that I was looking for. And he was wearing a suit. And it was a very touching moment because I saw how this had sort of changed his life. Now, deja vu, when I started private practice, one of my early patients was a 19-year-old sophomore at UCLA, and his pressure moment was going to tell his parents that he was gay. And I remembered what I learned with the first one. So this time, I ran him through a methodology. Again, we practiced everything. I gave him a lot of strategies. And when he told his parents, he started out by saying, Mom, Dad, I love you very much. I would never do anything to embarrass you. And then he started to sort of cry, and he blurted out that he was gay. His mother's first reaction was, I knew it. His father came up to him, gave him a big hug, and said, don't worry, you can be cured. And his sister came up to him and just hugged him and said, so what? I still love you. Well, when his parents left, it took him 20 minutes to calm down, but he got through it. So the message is sometimes you have to practice for your pressure moment. Most people are aware of Malcolm Gladwell, you know, use that phrase, 10,000 hours. The reason athletes do well is practice, 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 practice. The reason the A student aces their SATs is because they have studied, 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 and studied. So that's what people really have to do. Practicing is the number one way of building confidence. So again, it's that myth. Nobody rises to the occasion. They're just doing what they normally do.
We have a few minutes left. I want to go back for a second. You mention in the book that you've seen something you call pressure anxiety.
Pressure anxiety is what I have observed as a clinician is really becoming a contemporary plague. It's affecting everybody. And let me differentiate. There are some people who what I call are pressure performers. Anybody in their young 20s, 30s, maybe even their 40s are pressure performers, which means that they want to do well in the moment because every success they have advances their career. the executive who is 40 and he's having a big project. He is a pressure performer because if he does well on this project, he moves up the ladder. There are other people, and I would say usually 50 or older. I have a lot of friends, for example, who are very, very successful attorneys. None of them, when they go into court, feel any pressure. They've done this hundreds of times. They do not get nervous making an opening statement or closing deliberation. Their pressure is, how much longer do I have to pay for my daughter's apartment? How much longer do I have to pay for my son's education? These are people like Atlas who are walking around carrying the world upon their shoulders. That's what it feels like. And they are afraid to put it down because if they put it down, they think dire consequences will happen. And at the same time, they have uncertainty. How much longer can I do this? How much longer can I keep getting these big cases that are going to give me a lot of money? And that is what I call pressure anxiety. It is the perpetual feeling that you have to produce every single day, 24/7, because if you don't, you are going to be weeded out. And I would say this pressure anxiety, it keeps people up at night, and it's the first thought that they have when they wake up in the morning. And understand, we're living now in a world where there is more pressure than ever. And one of the reasons that people don't realize that is longevity. We're all living longer. You know, when I was growing up, the 30-year-old was not competing with the 60-year-old. Today, they are. So there's more people in the workforce. It's become more global. During the next 2 years, India, China, and Japan are going to have a million more applicants, college applicants, to U.S. schools. What do you think that's going to do? The director of admissions at Stanford told me getting into Stanford, it's like winning a lottery ticket. Every kid we reject is actually capable of getting in. So we have this anxiety every single day that we have to produce, and most people don't know how to get out of that. And this is why I say competition brings out the worst. I know a lot of very successful people. Successful people are usually very competitive, and it's a good thing because that means they're so successful they can afford to go to their therapist twice a week. That's what their competitive success gets them. Because if you're competitive, you're always trying to beat the other guy. I told my kids early on, don't worry about being better than the other person. Because the truth is, there's always somebody prettier. There's always somebody better at what you're doing. There's always somebody smarter. So instead of trying to compete with other people, that's what I call a ranking mindset. Trying to be number one always. Now, back in the day, it was good. If you're the number one cave guy, you get the best meat and you get the best girl. It's better to develop a mindset of excellence. Focus on being your best rather than trying to beat other people because there's always going to be somebody better. And that's one of the ways that you can get out of this pressure anxiety. And also, do you ever notice how many people say, I need this, I need this, I need this? You know, a need, one lady said, a need is clothes, a want is a Chanel label. That's really right. The difference. And I have found that my life has become a lot better when I clarify the difference between what I need. As Keith Richards said, you can't always get what you want, but you can usually get what you need.
Good message to go out on. Mm-hmm. Henry Weisinger, he's a psychologist and co-author with J.P. Palafrey of this book, Performing Under Pressure, The Science of Doing Your Best When It Matters Most. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith. Thanks for listening.
Will you just fight, fight? You get what you need.